This is a doctrine, so we're in tithing today. So we're going to try to finish this up. I'll get to that. I didn't give you any handouts on this. Just that one. Yeah. Okay. All right. We probably have as many doctrinal study papers on this topic as anything else on our website. Proof statement on third tithe and a tithing study paper, and there's one or two others up there I was looking at, but we won't have time to get into all the details of this, but we'll try to get into it. We were talking when did we last meet on this? Wednesday? Last Wednesday we talked about the fact that how many tithes does the Bible show us that it talks about? Who can tell me how many? Andrew, is that three? Three tithes? What's the first tithe for? Sky? The church. Who does the first tithe belong to? Charlie? Not quite. Sky? Belongs to God. God gave it to the Levites. We talked about that last time. And then under that system, that financed the work of the church under the Sinaitic system. But under the New Covenant, it belongs, God gives it to who, Charlie? The order of Melchizedek. Hebrews chapter 7 discusses that. We should talk briefly about that. I don't think I turned to that last time, but let's turn over to Hebrews chapter 7. We did talk about Matthew 23:23, that Christ said, render unto God, unto Caesar, that which is Caesar's, and unto God, that which is God's. Today, if you were to say to render unto Caesar that which belongs to Caesar, Kayla, what would you be talking? What part of the financial structure, economic structure, would you be talking about? What does belong?
It goes to the government.
Yeah. So what do we call that today? What do you pay to the government every year?
Taxes.
To taxes. Yes. When Christ said, "Give to Caesar that which is Caesar's," he was upholding the financial taxation structure of human government, whichever. Caesar during the time of the Roman Empire, the United States government today. So we are under that obligation. But he also said, unto God that which is God's. The only thing defined in the Bible that belongs to God is what we described the last time as the tithe, and that is the 10% of one's what? How do you figure the tithe? What is it based on? Julia? Okay, and what's the word for that from the Bible? Of your net profit. You're correct. Tim, was that a hand?
Increase.
Of your increase, which is your net gain after expenses. And then for you and I today, if you're not a farmer, small businessman or whatever, how do you figure your, according to our judgment that we have as a church, how do you figure your increase today on your paycheck? James? Okay, you're right. After you deduct your taxes, yeah, which would be your, in the United States, your federal income tax, Social Security, any local taxes that you would have as well. Andrew?
So briefly, I don't know if it was in this class or not, we talked about how some of our taxes that go to like Social Security and or to give to the, or used by the government to give to those who are like in need. Some say that has possibly been considered our third tithe, which would mean that we wouldn't have to. What's your opinion on that?
Right, but we haven't got to that third tithe yet. But that's essentially correct. When we get to it, which hopefully we'll do today, we'll discuss that third tithe, yeah. Okay. Well, right now, the first tithe is what is described here as the Lord's to given to the Levites. Mentioned several places throughout the scriptures. Malachi chapter 3 talks about robbing God by withholding tithes. Christ in Matthew 23, verse 23, as I mentioned, said that to the hypocrites of the Pharisees, verse 23, he says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint, anise, and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." The others undone, don't leaving them undone, is to the tithe that God's law defines. Now, in Hebrews chapter 7, we have the passage that describes the changing of this law. Beginning in verse 5, those who were, it says, who are the sons of Levi, which are the Levites who had the service of the temple, to him, them was given that tithe under the old covenant system, who received the priesthood, have a commandment to receive tithes from the people according to the law. That is, from their brethren, though they have come from the loins of Abraham. Remember, we talked then last week in Genesis that Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. Tithing predates the covenant at Sinai, that whole system. Then it was included within that system, given to the Levites. Verse 6 says, "But he whose genealogy is not derived from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises." Now, beyond all contradiction, the lesser's blessed by the greater. Here mortal men receive tithes, but there he receives them of whom it is witnessed that he lives. Even Levi, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, so to speak, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. So what Paul is arguing here is that even though he wasn't even born, Levi paid tithes through his ancestor, Abraham. And that connection was made and passed down in that sense. Verse 11 says, "If perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should arise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be called according to the order of Aaron? For the priesthood being changed of necessity, there is also a change of the law, for he of whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe from which no man has officiated at the altar," speaking of Jesus, from another tribe, the tribe of Judah. And as verse 14 goes on to say. So the change of the law in verse 12 that is referenced here is talking in the context about this law of tithing, then that now goes to the priesthood of Melchizedek, which is the New Testament ministry operating within the church, which is the body of Christ, in which Christ himself is the head, to fund the work of the church. So we take that to understand then that the order of Christ, the Melchizedek order of Christ, has replaced the Levitical priesthood in the administration of a different covenant, what we call the New Covenant, and the work done today in the spiritual work by the ministry uses that tithe to fund then the work of the church. We talked about all the various funding that operates out of that tithe that is collected from all of the church to do that. Now, there is a reference in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, beginning in verse 4, where Paul, the apostle, speaks to the church and the right to live from the proceeds of a funding that he refers to here. The problem within the church at Corinth was they had a number of problems, but part of it dealt with their criticism of Paul and his operations. Beginning in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 4, Paul says, "Do we not have no right to eat and drink?" It's kind of a rhetorical question. You say the answer is obvious. Yes, we do have a right to eat and drink. "Do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do also the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord, and Cephas," or Peter? And the answer is, yes, we have the right to take along a wife if we so choose. "Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working, supporting ourselves by other employment? Whoever goes to war at his own expense?" Well, the answer is, a soldier is employed by his government, drafted by his government to go to war. The government pays the expenses to outfit the man going to war. And his obvious implication is, in this spiritual work, which is also in Ephesians 6, described as a spiritual warfare, he's saying, do we pay for that ourselves? Again, it's a rhetorical question, and the answer is no. Who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit? The worker can come along and take from the vineyard part of that fruit. Or who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of the flock? Do I say these things as a mere man, or does not the law say the same also? For it's written in the law of Moses, you will not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. The ox can eat from the grain that it's actually working to produce. Is it oxen God's concerned about, or does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be partakers of this hope. Skipping down, if others are partakers of this right over you, are we not even more? And this right is understood to mean the right to take offerings or a tithe from them to help fund their work so that they can provide spiritually for the church. At the end of verse 14, even so the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel, from the efforts and the fruits of the gospel. So the tithing system that we find described of an increase given to the Levites, prefigured by what Abraham gave to Melchizedek out of the spoils of that battle, is what we define and look at then as the first tithe, which funds the work of the church. And in our modern setting, this would mean all the administrative aspects of the church, which would involve expenses for a ministry in terms of salary, other expenses, local congregational expenses, everything to camp, to, I mentioned ABC and the funding of the preaching of the gospel that we do as part of our mission, producing literature, magazines, preaching the gospel there, caring for the church and the disciples that God adds. So this first tithe is used in that way, and we budget and administer accordingly in our operations within the church today. Any questions about first tithe and application, administration, and so on? We're fortunate in America in that still to this day, it has been for many years, when we the charitable offerings and monies given to the church, considered a charity, or any other church, is tax deductible in America under American tax code. And so there is a benefit that is given there that by the government, but under if we were completely under God's government, essentially the tithe would be the tax, and we wouldn't be filing a tax return right now anyway, and I think you know how that operates. But America is a unique nation in its tax code that way, that it does provide for that. A little known, Caleb, go ahead.
Is there any mention of how frequently one should calculate their first tithe or submit it? Is it typically every paycheck? Is it typically every month?
As a salaried individual, it's logical and better to do it as you are paid. If you're a businessman, you may not do that maybe except on a quarterly basis.
Okay.
Farmer would do that on an annual basis when they can figure a true increase.
And in ancient Israel, would they have just brought it when they came to the temple? So it would have been like three times a year?
I was mentioning the unique American tax code. There is one other unique feature of the American tax code I should mention to you, just so you're aware of it, informational. It doesn't apply to you, but it helps you to understand. And by the way, the ministry of the church pays first tithe, just so there's no question about that. Sometimes people sometimes feel or under the impression the ministry does not tithe. That's not true. We always have tithed, and we are paid a salary. We tithe off of our salary, just like everybody else does. The United States tax code has a unique feature that is called a parsonage exclusion. All right? This gets into the Protestant ethic, religious nature of American culture, but essentially what it is, any ordained minister of any denomination may exclude, they can exclude from their taxable income any expense dealing with a parsonage, which is a fancy word for a house that a minister lives in, okay? So, a minister who buys a house, and I buy a house, and I'm a minister, so I can deduct the cost, I can exclude from taxation, the taxable part of my income, my mortgage payment, the interest, the property taxes that I pay, the whole house insurance that I pay, what else? Anything, you know, if I put a new roof on or anything dealing with the expense of keeping up that home. Refrigerator goes out, air conditioner goes out, I put a new air conditioner. That annual cost is figured. There's formulas for putting all this in. And as far as the IRS is concerned, if I exclude, let's just pick a number, $20,000 of my annual salary as part as what it takes to keep me in a home, I don't think it takes me that much, but let's just say $20,000. That $20,000 is not taxed by the U.S. federal government. I still pay tithes on it to the church, but it is a unique benefit only in America as far as I know. I don't think any other nation on the earth does it, but it is a unique benefit that every minister in every denomination has in the United States of America, but it's only for ordained individuals. If you're a clerk working in the mailroom or you're not ordained and you're working in, let's say, for the church in some clerical way, you're not ordained, you cannot take that by IRS tax code. So you may not have known that, but it's one of those little things, and it's a great advantage for the ministry in the United States. James? You have to supply a certificate from your body to verify that, which we can and which we do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they've talked about doing away with that in America, but they never have done it yet. There's a powerful nonprofit lobby that keeps that going. But other parts of America, American economy, they get benefits too. Farmers, agricultural workers, farmers get a lot of things in the tax thing. The taxation structure is a whole other issue of discussion. President Ronald Reagan a few years ago quipped in an off-the-cuff comment, but it was true, that he said, you know, it was a whole lot easier if you just look at what the Bible says, 10%, and then you could do away with the tax code. President Reagan really wanted to monkey with the tax code, and he got the last big tax cut that we've had before this recent one under President Trump. But it's true, you know. Then you read the Bible. God warned Israel, "Well, you want a king? All right, I'll give you a king, but he's going to tax you, and he's going to take your men, and send them off to war, and do this and do that. But that's what you want. We'll give it to you." And that's what we've had ever since. So. God's system of taxation, i.e. a tithe, makes far better sense. That's the original flat tax from God. But that's, you know, we have to do the best that we can with that. Any questions about what I've just said? Kerr?
This might be just a minor thing, but does the insurance also include as deduction, like for the net income for the wages here?
Insurance?
Like medical insurance, like not for medical, personal?
Not medical insurance.
Okay. So for
this parsonage exclusion?
No, just general for computing your 10% tax.
Oh. No. I think our statement basically incorporates any taxes.
Taxes. Okay, so
FICA taxes or Social Security taxes would be included mm-hmm. in that.
Okay.
So unless you're on Medicare, that's not medical. I'm sorry.
Are there like companies that like take it off your salary? So if that's the case, should you add it back if you compute for your tithings?
Take what off your salary?
Like for contribution from employee and employer, does that?
For medical?
Yes.
You're right.
Oh,
so you would have to add back in the medical.
Yeah, that's why.
T- To come to your net, yeah. Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, to abide technically with, let's say, a ruling we've made about that, if that's what you wanted to do, then you would add back in your medical insurance. Yeah. You want to be honest with God, and it's always better to go above and beyond and kick in a little extra or whatever. So, again, those are issues that you have to decide based on your balance sheet. Yeah. Okay, any other questions? All right, let's talk about the second tithe, or what we tend to call it today more the festival tithe, or the second tithe. All right, we've said first, second, third tithe, three tithes, and some, our critics at times over the years, they look at the Church of God and they write about it and say, oh, they just rob their members. They demand and command 30% of their income, three tithes, to give to the church. Well, we talk about three tithes or 30%, yes, but does it all go to the church? No. The festival tithe doesn't go to the church. The festival tithe is to be used to observe the holy days. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 17 through 18. Are one reference regarding this. And in Deuteronomy 16, verses 13 through 15, your sheet probably has this, but these are two explicit references to a tithe that is different from this tithe. And how do you know it's different? Because when we read about it, the individual consumes this tithe for the festivals, the holy days. Deuteronomy 12, verse 17, it says, you'll not eat within your gates the tithe of your grain or your new wine or your oil, but you must eat them in the place before the Lord your God, in the place which the Lord your God shall choose. You and your son, your daughter, your male and female servants, the Levite within your gates, and you will rejoice before the Lord your God in all to which you put your hands. Okay? The place where God chooses to put his name, okay? I'll just put the word place up here. This we have interpreted and applied in our setting today to be where we have the holy days observed, all right? Jekyll Island, Panama City, wherever, or for the other annual festivals, Cincinnati, Raleigh, Portsmouth, wherever we might be, the place being where the church is meeting, where the church has organizationally said, this is where we will keep the holy day. So that's how we interpret it. And we, if you look at Deuteronomy 16, verse 13, it says, you shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days when you've gathered from your threshing floor and your winepress, and you will rejoice in your feast, you and your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant. Well, we don't have male and female servants today, but it shows you what they had in this setting. They did have servants. The law identifies that and even identifies the treatment for those servants that were a part of that structure, the stranger and the fatherless. So you took care of those without, and a stranger would mean an alien living within your midst, all right, an immigrant for a period of time. Usually it would be someone that maybe they came over from Moab or Edom, and they were working in Bethlehem on contract in the wine or the olive oil industry, okay? And they were there for X number of years, and they may not have been keeping the tithe or fully invested in your system, but they were a stranger, i.e. an immigrant without status. You took care of that person as well. So built into the law was a generosity toward others, including the fatherless, it says, the widow, that are within your gates or within your community, your realm. 7 days you'll keep a sacred feast to the Lord in the place which he chooses. And this would mean 7 days could be either the Days of Unleavened Bread, clearly defined in the law, or even the Feast of Tabernacles. And certainly by extension, because we know three times in a year, Deuteronomy 16:16 says, you will appear before the Lord. So Pentecost would be the third season or third time of the year. But this is a clear distinction by the nature of this second festival tithe that is commanded by God for the families to be able to keep the festivals, and the expenses of that would cover their travel, their food, and their lodging. Now, under the old covenant structure, they first went to a place called Shiloh, where the tabernacle resided during the days of the judges, in that period before there was a monarchy in Jerusalem and a temple structure was built in Jerusalem. But after a temple was built in Jerusalem, then everything was directed there, all right? And people would go up there. These were the only two spots sanctioned for the feasts, all right? And you'll note, neither one of them has a beach. They don't, all right? That's just my little comment there. This is where they went. And, you know, we find in the Gospels, Christ went up with his parents to Jerusalem when he was 12, and they left him there. They forgot about him when they went home to Nazareth. So people would gather up their things, and they would travel in caravans, riding donkeys, riding in carts, and walking. And they would go to these places. You read in 1 Samuel, what was Samuel's mother's name? Hannah. Hannah went up every year to Shiloh. She was going up for one of the festivals, and that's where she really got this strong desire for her son. She was childless. Then ultimately, Samuel was born, but they went up to Shiloh. So for years, we find little snatches of information where they did it in Scripture. We don't get a lot of detail other than what we find right here in the law. Okay. Now, what we have done they carried their chickens up there. They took a goat, probably took a cow. Maybe some of it had been converted by barter before they ever left for what they needed, a jug of wine. It would have been more than just a jug here, probably would have been a huge jug of wine. And figs and dates and other common matters. And they went up and then they camped. And they would slaughter their food and cook it. You know, it was a big South African braai for 7-8 days. And they made their food. They didn't have Kentucky Fried Chicken. They didn't have fancy steakhouses. They didn't have, what's your favorite spot to go when you go to the feasts, wherever you go? Captain Alexander's? They didn't have that. All right, they had to create it all. And I'm sure there were some elaborate setups. I've always told people, if you want to try to do what they did in Shiloh or Jerusalem today, go to Africa and keep a feast. A few years ago, we went to Kenya, went to 3 sites in Kenya. They were camping out in the open, in the fields, and we drove into the compound where they were keeping it, and you see chickens running around in the morning, and you were eating those chickens that night. Got that, Charlie? Okay. They were skinning the goat in the morning that they had just freshly slaughtered, and it was hanging in the kitchen and flies all over it, and we were gnawing on it by sundown that night. Yeah, but I didn't worry about it because we were washing it down with vodka or gin, whatever we had to keep further sanitize it. They had cooked it. I saw it being cooked, and it was charcoal black, and when they gave us a grocery sack full of goat, and we took it back to our hotel and we ate it. It was interesting. It wasn't too bad, but we drank a little extra vodka or gin that night just to make sure we had everything sanitized. Because that morning we walked into the kitchen and the ladies were cutting that goat up, throwing it over into a tin wash basin, and you looked at it and flies all over it. And then they were cooking it while I was preaching on the eighth day, and then I was eating it later. You go to Africa, you just kind of throw certain things out the window and plunge in and take your chances. But that's a little bit closer to the way they kept it back here than the way we keep it today in Panama City or wherever we like to go. What we have done in the church today, you should understand, we have adapted an agrarian-based harvest cultural festival to a 21st century model, all right? They would not, an Israelite coming in to keep the feast with us today would say, what in the world are you doing? They couldn't relate to it, but we couldn't relate to theirs either. But we have, beginning with Mr. Armstrong, we have adapted in many ways the tithing structure, the means by which we keep it, where we go out to a spot for 7 days, then the eighth day to keep the feast. And that's how we do it with our understanding in a modern industrial society. You have to understand that. As you would look at and judge what we do, especially with this, because you know we save 10% along through the year, then we take that money and we fund it to go to keep all the other festivals, but primarily the Feast of Tabernacles will take the bulk of it. And that this is all by the judgment and tradition that we have in the church. There was a time back in the mid-1970s in the church, mid-75, I remember, it was the first in my age of the gas shortages because of upset in the Middle East. And you couldn't get gas for a period of time without lining up for hours and hours at a time at the local gas station. And the church was discussing the possibility that we might not keep the feast that year. Or if we did, we'd have to keep it locally. And I remember thinking, wow, that would be a change. But if the church had to make that administrative decision because of an emergency situation, that's perfectly fine. You should understand that. We used to keep 7 days of unleavened bread like we keep the 7 days Feast of Tabernacles. People would go and stay in motels and even tents and do that in the spring. After a couple of years in the church in my youth, we changed that and we just do it now in our local areas. Should that ever happen again where we would say, well, we're not going to keep all 7 days of the feast. We're just going to keep the first day locally and we'll keep the eighth day. Legitimately, the church could make such a judgment. You should understand that. I hope we don't, and I hope we don't have to because of any emergency situation. But I want you to understand that what we have done is made judgments to create the traditions, the traditional way by which we keep the festival, the holy days, and primarily the Feast of Tabernacles today. Mr. Armstrong kept the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 years, just he and his wife all alone. Then they finally realized, I think God was leading them to understand, well, we've got to keep these separately, or we have to go apart from the world. And so they rented kind of a holiday camp up in Oregon, and those in the church with them at the time, for 7 years, they kind of did it that way. And then the church began to grow, and I think God has blessed the church in the way that we keep it, in many, many ways spiritually. It is a cohesive, unifying factor for the church. But as we've applied these scriptures, especially here, it has been as we've read it, well, what does that mean for us today in the 20th or 21st century? And we make judgments. We should always make a judgment and build a tradition based upon the spiritual intent or principle of the law, but understand certain things in terms of especially how we keep the Feast of Tabernacles today. I always like to say, since I didn't teach the doctrine, I'll get this little point in, that I've traveled all over the world to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, and I enjoy that, but in recent years, I've come to appreciate the fact that what Deuteronomy 12 and Deuteronomy 16, 14 talk about in terms of the principles of keeping the feast, that's the core. It's to fear God, it's to be with people, and fellowship, your family, the strangers, the Levite, the fatherless, and to sit down and have a meal with everybody. And maybe that's a communal meal that we would have, and or we go out to a restaurant, or we do this. But the Feast of Tabernacles is essentially you come to fear God, to obey God, and you fellowship with one another, and you make sure everybody else is a part of a family, a spiritual family. And you basically have a meal. Those are the three components, scripturally, that you find for the Feast of Tabernacles. Everything else is gravy. Panama City Beach, Puerto Vallarta, or Bend, Oregon, or wherever you like to go. But if you want to understand maybe what the original people kept it, and some of the original, just read Deuteronomy, then think about You know what they did? I used to tell my members, unless you've camped in a tent at the Feast of Tabernacles, you haven't kept the Feast of Tabernacles. That was my mantra. And I was being facetious, but I was making a point that our nice condos are nice, but there you go. So I was basically trying to get them to say, let's pare it back to the essentials: God, people, and food. That's really what the law says. That constitutes the feast: God, people, and food. Now, if you want to do that in Jekyll Island, that's great. If we want to do it in Panama City, just keep it all in mind. It's not the casinos. It's not all the other trappings of it that are that important, although as we do them, that's fine. Just don't skip church or skip fellowship or skip being with God's people and put all those other things first in that way. We need to always continue to think about that as we do that. Any questions about festival tithe? James.
Are you running your own business? Are you thinking about this verse to say that closed down for that time period and let everyone go?
That's what they would do. Yeah. And a business owner would today typically do that. Certainly for the holy days. There are certain businesses that might need to remain open during the non-holy day period of either the spring or the fall.
Yeah, because like
your dad probably shuts down the holy days, but he doesn't shut down the whole week.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's the judgment that we've always operated by. Yeah. If you were to get in your Wayback Machine and go back to the time of Hannah and Elkanah in 1 Samuel chapter 1, and you read the law, you go up to where God has placed his name, but you've got a village of a few hundred people, and there are crops out there, and there are still goats and calves that they're not either slaughtering to eat during the feast, because you're not going to kill everything off, because you won't have any stock for the ongoing stock. And you're not going to drive them all with you up to Shiloh. They're going to be left in the fields. Somebody's going to stay behind in the village and take care of it. That's the principle. That's the logic of what you know had to have happened. Years ago, when we had the big physical plants especially in Pasadena, California, huge, big buildings, big physical plant, press machines, offices, buildings. The feast was not there. The feast was in Squaw Valley, Northern California, up in the mountains, Sierra Mountains. But they had to leave a skeleton crew of employees in the Pasadena campus to keep the lights on and to guard it so that you just didn't walk away from it all. And for years, that was done, ever since we had that physical plant. Big Sandy wasn't the case because we had a feast site there. Brickwood, England, we had to do the same thing. And then eventually that got big enough that a minister would stay behind. They started having services at least. Some type of Bible studies. So that's how we've applied that logically through the year. You just don't walk away from everything. And they would not have walked away from everything during this time. You couldn't take every animal with you. And somebody had to stay and feed those animals. So not everybody went up every year is the point. Sky? Okay. Any other questions about the festival tithe? You keep that. You administer that yourself, and that's your business. And as you spend it upon yourself and others, you do it based on take the scripture and make your judgments. So we'll take Emily.
So I've heard people say it's like wrong to use your festival tithe for something like buying a laptop or something that you're not really using for the feast at that time. Mm-hmm. But then in the Bible, it also talks about like they were buying oxen and stuff. I assume they weren't buying them just then to slaughter, right? Wouldn't they also be buying them for like to take back home with them?
At the feast?
I mean, maybe it's a place where a bunch of people are and you're not going there so often and you're going to have an opportunity to buy something and take it back with you. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
I've never actually done this. It's an issue I've heard brought up.
Well, okay. I don't know that they had a cattle auction at Shiloh or Jerusalem, okay, during the feast. I doubt that they did. They probably went up there with what they were planning to consume and consumed it and you know, on third day of the feast, I doubt they had a cattle auction to auction off, you know, prized cattle for stock and breeding stock. Could be wrong, but the scripture doesn't tell us that. And beyond that, the law doesn't speak to it, so it's your speculation is mine. How we apply that then today is based on the broad principle of whatsoever your heart desires. Now, there's the broad distinction that it is used to keeping the festivals. The bulk of it is going to be spent for that. Let's be blunt. Some people make a lot of money annually, and the amount of festival tithe that they have is going to be far and above what they need to go to Jekyll Island or even to Greece if they really splurge on a big trip like that. They still might have triple X number or 4X, you know, numbers of dollars left over. What do they do with that? Okay. Again, all I would, the church, we don't get into that legislating of it. If you meet all the obligations defined in the law to travel to keep, you've taken care of others, given some to others in the congregation that might not have enough to help them have a nice feast, family members, et cetera, and you still have a lot. You've taken care of the primary biblical obligations. My personal feeling is, and I'll be blunt with you, I have a very liberal approach toward the festival tithe, okay? And I would say that, you know, that is between you and God in that. I do feel we have, in our adaptation of this agrarian Old Testament principle here into a New Testament modern setting, there's going to be a broad spectrum upon which those decisions can be made. So I tend to let people make those judgments based on the law and their conscience. I don't think you should go making your mortgage payment or go buy a new Jaguar with it, okay? But I suppose if Donald Trump came into the church and he took a tithe of his annual earnings, he might be befuddled as to how to take care of that. Maybe he'd buy you a Jaguar. And would you say no? Well, that's be between you and Donald Trump, okay? Another question.
So I guess it's a little bit weird, but so if somebody gives you, I feel like I asked this before maybe, somebody gives you money for the feast,
mm-hmm.
Like I've had families do that before, and they'll be like, oh, here's like $100 for the feast. Do I have to tithe on that?
No, you're using that for the feast. That's a gift for that purpose. You don't have to tithe. If you want to take a portion of that and put it into the offering, that's your business too. People take out of their festival tithe and add to their offering. And that's permissible too. But technically you wouldn't tithe on that. Okay? Sky, or Julie, and then Sky.
Okay. Well, then you mentioned about how sometimes we might have extra on second tithe leftover. Mm-hmm. Is it acceptable for us to, are we required to use all of our festival tithe on
no.
that year?
Or,
so we can save it and use it?
Extra? Yes, you can. Church made a judgment on that decades ago. If you didn't need all that much money to stay here in Cincinnati for the feast or to go to Panama City and you wanted to go to Italy or whatever, you can save that over. Again, have you met the obligations here? Strive to do that, and then what you have left over, you want to save for next year, we've judged on that years ago that that's permissible to do. You don't have to turn all that in or just blow it, and spend it on stuff. You can do that. Charlie. Wait a minute. Sky first. Okay. Okay? Charlie? Yeah, I stayed in Cincinnati, and I stayed in my home and came into the Holiday Inn Eastgate, and I used the money that I saved to help other widows, give them a little extra money, who got down here and ran out of money, or take people out and to save for Greece, Italy, or wherever else, you know, in the future. But I want to sleep in my own bed when possible, and so I did. Yeah, the temporary dwelling thing is good. I mean, it's obviously, when you went here, you were going to one spot, you're going to be in a temporary dwelling. Your temporary dwelling is a condo on Panama City Beach or some lodge in Colorado or wherever. That may be temporary, but it may be better than what you live in throughout the rest of the year as well. So it's nice and all, but don't get into the judgment aspect that you've got to be in a Motel 6. You can be in your house and still keep the feast in those locations. I would not say that you would want to stay home and put a Sukkoth up in your backyard to keep the feast. I don't think that's the appropriate way to keep the feast as the church is judged. I hope you're not talking about that.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no. But if, you know, that's only going to apply to a few cases where people live in the proximity of a feast site. Yeah. This year I could not justify spending $1,000. I'd rather spend that money for taking a few people out, which I did, and giving to some others that needed some extra money there. So don't get legalistic in your application of any part of the law, whether it's the Sabbath keeping or even on this one where we have adapted that whole structure into a modern setting. Look at the law, look at the teaching, use God's spirit, be balanced, but don't get legalistic on it. On this particular point, I'm glad you brought it up, but sometimes people look, you know, last year when people said, are you staying at the Holiday Inn? I said, no, I'm staying in my house. And I could see, oh, they thought I was Laodicean.
Yeah, I asked because I hear a lot of people be like,
little old lady that used to drive us to the feast, peeking around over, couldn't even get it above the steering wheel. She's a fine lady. We were tent camping in Big Sandy. And there were people staying in a motor lodge in Gladewater, Texas, which wasn't a condo, wasn't Sheraton. And she thought they weren't keeping it properly because they weren't in a tent on the grounds in Big Sandy, and she wanted the ministers to get after them. She was fussing around our campsite while they're not keeping it right by staying in this motel. You see where you go when you start down that road? It's called Alice in Wonderland. And you don't want to, when it comes to these matters, you don't want to go into Alice in Wonderland. Okay? Anybody's got any questions on that one? We can take it offline, but otherwise, we'll do the third tithe on Wednesday, and then we'll get into the next teaching, which is military service and war.